from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Former Secretary of State and five-term U.S. Senator John Kerry says he's never seen as much chaos in a president's administration as he sees in President Trump's, and he's concerned about Trump's ability to lead.
You have a president who clearly doesn't understand America, doesn't understand the Constitution, and that's dangerous.
Coming up, John Kerry joins us in studio to discuss the current state of U.S. politics, the importance of the upcoming 2018 elections, and his new memoir, Every Day is Extra. That's next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In his new memoir, Every Day is Extra, former Secretary of State and five-term U.S. Senator John Kerry provides an expansive account of his life and career on Capitol Hill. From his time in Vietnam to his failed 2004 presidential bid, Kerry offers a personal take on some of his most public moments. He also offers new insights on his diplomatic work, including negotiating the Paris Climate Accord and Iran nuclear deal. And he joins us this hour to talk about his political career and his perspective on current political climate in Washington. Welcome, John Kerry.
Thank you, Michael. I'm delighted to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Pleased to have you back here. I don't know whether to call you Secretary Kerry or Senator Kerry, so how about just John?
Will that serve? That's great. That's fine.
Well, you've been on the program before, and I'm delighted to have you back here. Let's begin, though, by talking about – there's lots to talk about in your autobiography, to put it mildly. I want to talk about the summit. I call it the Brown-Bloomberg Summit because those are the two who are sponsoring it along with the United Nations. And your stake in all this and what you feel is particularly more important. I notice in your book, for example, there are two photographs, a very touching photograph, which we touched on, actually, in discussion about climate change with your granddaughter on your lap when you were signing the Paris Accord, and also a picture of you in Antarctica and meeting up there a couple of years ago with some of the major scientists and really becoming a full-fledged believer, if you weren't before that.
I've been a believer for 30 years or more.
That swayed you on the science, I think, though, didn't it?
Well, no, it didn't sway me. I was already swayed. What it did was it gave me a deeper understanding of how perilous and how fast bad things are happening. I went to the Arctic, and the Arctic scientist said to me, you know, you really won't understand fully how dangerous it is unless you go to Antarctica. So I went to Antarctica. I actually was flying to Antarctica when we got the news President Trump had, you know, Trump had actually won the election. We almost stayed in Antarctica. But I fully appreciated it for years, and I worked in the Senate way back with Al Gore and Tim Wirth and other senators on this issue. Went to Rio in 1992, so I've been involved for a long time.
So what do you think when, you know, Greg Pruitt comes aboard and all these regulations begin to fall away? Now they're actually trying to get away with removing methane regulations, a very important part of climate change, and also climate deniers in the White House?
This is, it's insanity. It's the only thing you can call it. It's insanity. It's an invitation to join in a suicide pact, which is what this administration is engaging in. And people who don't understand that and who turn their backs on the science are culpable of putting a lot of their fellow citizens in danger. As a result of the decisions President Trump has made, people are going to die. It's that simple. I mean, we're not stopping what we need to do to reverse the current trend. Paris was an effort to try to hold the Earth's temperature to 2 degrees centigrade increase. We are now on track to hit 4 degrees. And the impact of that in terms of what happens with water, what happens with farming, what happens with food production, what happens with fires, what happens with these storms that are gaining in their intensity because of the warming of the water and the amount of moisture that is then added to a storm, and the higher intensity the storm gains as a consequence of that. I went to Antarctica, saw what the West Antarctic ice sheet may become. As we've seen the Larsen ice sheet break off and float out to sea, If it continues to deteriorate, we're going to see huge magnitudes of sea level increase. So it's so dangerous. And to have a president who turns his back willfully on facts and on science is the exact opposite of what you need in today's world.
This is also a president who takes a great deal of credit for his administration's work in Puerto Rico. We have another major hurricane coming up, Florence.
Puerto Rico is absolutely stunning. You know, 2 days ago on 9/11, I was in New York and the epicenter, and we wake up to a president on 9/11 whose tweets are not about 9/11, not about the solemnity of the day, but who is attacking Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General of the United States. And even today, here we are with a storm barreling down in the Carolinas, where all the focus ought to be on the preparation. What is Donald Trump doing? Donald Trump is lying openly about his performance with respect to Puerto Rico. And, you know, everything he says, this is a quote. He said, it actually touched down as a Category 5. People have never seen anything like that. Well, guess what? It touched down as a Category 4. And yes, people have seen Category 5s before. Then he says the power plant has been wiped out. It's not like, let's go back and fix it. What are we going to do with the power plant? Well, guess what? By the way, he repeated what he said, which is what he always does. He says everything twice, the same thing. But somehow thinking that's profound. But the power plants were not severely damaged, let alone wiped out. And he just runs through. I give you 10 different statements about what happened in Puerto Rico that are just absolute lies. So we know now, and Bob Woodward's book confirms the details of how out of touch this man is. But it's dangerous for all of us. He's tearing apart our alliances in Europe. He's you know, made our closest allies worry about what the next steps may be, from Canada to NATO. And it's a dangerous time for our country. And we're all going to have to step up and make the course correction we need in this election in 2 months.
Well, is that the only way to fight this?
It's the most immediate way, Michael. It really is. The most immediate thing we can do. I mean, some people talk about the 25th Amendment, but that relies on his cabinet. It relies on his vice president. It's not something we can control. Or you talk about impeachment. I think it's a mistake to be running around barreling about impeachment right now because it politicizes impeachment. And we don't want impeachment to be the centerpiece of this election. We want the plight of Americans to be the centerpiece. We want the agenda for making life better for average Americans, which means talking about keeping health care, not destroying it by guaranteeing that people with pre-existing conditions can't get health care. We want to make sure that we're making the workplace fair again. I mean, what we ought to be talking about, and I believe this wholeheartedly, you know, America is a great country. We're a great country now. We do great things around the world for people. And the American people have unbelievable generosity. But What Donald Trump is doing has made America unfair. We need to make America fair again so that if you're working hard, you can actually get ahead. Now, last couple of weeks, we've seen some uptick numbers. But the problem is trade war is going to raise the prices on goods. It's already doing it. And so whatever increase in income people have had because of the, you know, raging economy that we have is going to be taken away very quickly. And it's not sustainable. I'll tell you what else is not sustainable. When 52% of America's income goes to 1% of Americans, that is not a sustainable political equation. And that's where we are today. So I think we Democrats need to put a alternative agenda to the country about health care, about education, about building, rebuilding America, doing the things that invest in the future.
You can't just do it on anti-Trump. Obviously.
No, I think it's a waste of time. I mean, I don't want to waste my time on his tweets on a daily basis. Everybody knows. He wakes up, he's pathologically disturbed. He clearly is unhinged and incapable of performing the duty of president. Everybody in Washington understands that.
You've said he's incapable of governing.
Even Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and the Republicans privately, they all talk about it. They know what's going on, but they've created this Faustian bargain where they're more willing to defend president, party, and power than they are to defend the Constitution and the role of the Senate.
You've also said he's hugely damaged our credibility. I wanted to get these quotes online here because you've been asked, and some people think you've been kind of coy about, would you run against Trump in 2020 if Trump lasts in this office? And the Washington Post got you to say, well, you know, this is too early to even...
Well, I haven't been coy about it. I hate the concept. I'm not being coy. I'm just personally not excited about now about hearing about 2020 when we have an election in 2 months that can be the centerpiece of a great course correction. If we win back the House of Representatives, if we win the United States Senate, the whole game changes. All the possibilities change. And to be, you know, getting sucked into the who's up, who's down of 2020 is a ridiculous pastime. I don't want to take part in it right now.
Is President Obama now kind of a new norm, you know, going out and campaigning? You're going to be campaigning. How much effect is that going to have? And the reason I ask that question is because President Obama campaigned a great deal for Hillary Clinton, and he wanted essentially those voters who voted for him to vote for Hillary Clinton, particularly voters of color. They didn't turn out in the way that it had been hoped for.
No, the turnout. Listen, the turnout is the story of the last election. 54.2% of eligible voters decided to come out and vote during the 2016 election. When Barack Obama was elected in 2008, the turnout was 62.43%. And when he was reelected, it was 58.5 or so. So you see the difference. The last time we had a 54.2% turnout of eligible voters, guess what? It was the Al Gore year. So everybody ought to just shudder at this notion that in the United States of America, which takes our democracy out to the rest of the world and holds it up as an example, only 54% of the people in our country see fit to vote. Frankly, that's disgraceful. It's just wrong. And it does matter. That is how we changed the world back in 1971-72 when Richard Nixon was in office and the Vietnam War was raging. And what happened was, I remember when I came back from Vietnam, I first involved myself in Earth Day, 1970. We turned out 20 million Americans who said, I don't want to live next to a toxic waste site. I don't want to have a dump giving my children and myself cancer and so forth. So guess what we did? We made those issues voting issues. And people came out and voted on them. And the message that we targeted the 12 worst votes in the Congress, labeled them the Dirty Dozen. And seven of those 12 lost their seats in the 72 election. What happened? We saw the Clean Air Act passed, safe drinking water passed, marine mammal protection, coastal zone management. The EPA was actually created and Richard Nixon signed it. So here we are in 1972. Nixon wins with 49 states. 49 states he carried in 72, and before 74, he was gone, resigned, because the American people created accountability in the electoral process. That's what we need to do in 2 months.
Nixon is now being assessed as a pretty good environmental president. I mean, particularly when you think about a comparison to the present administration. But since you mentioned—
Can I mention one other thing?
Yeah,
you just mentioned methane. Methane, I get so upset at this. Methane is 20 times more powerfully dangerous, damaging to the environment than CO2.
And carbon, yeah.
And carbon. And here we are struggling to try to rein in carbon. This administration is now going to allow more methane to be released into the atmosphere, which sets back many of the gains that we have made. I don't know where the constituency is. Who's asking for that? A few corporate chieftains, a few donors to the Republican Party. It's an absolute disgrace that this administration is now allowing more coal sludge and dust to go into rivers, go into lakes, and now methane is going to be, and on automobiles, they're going to walk back the automobile standards. Never has the urgency been so great for us to go out and throw people out of office and put people in who want to make a difference. And that's something we can do in this democracy still.
I feel your anger, Senator, but I'm also prompted to ask you, are you as angry on this score as you perhaps ought to be about, well, what became your major legacies, the two agreements that you brokered? I'm talking about the Paris Agreement, which, of course, ties in with our discussion about environment and climate change, but also, and we want to talk about it, the deal with Iran.
Well, let me just qualify what you said, anger. Yeah, I'm passionate about it. I'm frustrated by it. But I'm not going to let anger, you know, I'm not going to be the angry guy. I'm going to try to direct my frustration into action. And that's what we have to do. It's what everybody has to do. But on the Paris Accords, of course, I'm concerned about what the president has done. But I'm very proud of what governors and mayors across the United States have done in response to that. We organized a lot of governors. The governors organized themselves and we worked all together. But we created a movement that stood up the very next day after Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Accords, and everybody stood up and said, you know, Governor Jay Inslee of Washington, Governor Jerry Brown of California, Governor Cuomo of New York, others said, we're still in. We're going to continue to try to hold the Paris Agreement. And indeed, formally, legally, you can't step out of the Paris Agreement until the day after the 2020 election. So we're still in the agreement, even though the president isn't doing anything and he's working in an opposite direction. But 38 states in the United States of America have what's called a renewable portfolio law, laws that require them to meet a certain renewable energy standard over the next year.
This is a whole subnational movement. That's what
subnational,
it's being
said, yeah. Yes, a subnational movement. And we have more than 1,000 mayors have signed on in America to try to meet the standards of Paris. So that those 38 states equal about 80% of the population in the United States.
We had four of those mayors on yesterday. I'm just wondering, though, if you think, I mean, I don't want to sound apocalyptic, but in many people's minds, it may be too late. We're not moving the needle as much as we need to move it.
Well, I'm one of those people who is deeply concerned about where we find ourselves. And I will say so at the climate summit tomorrow and otherwise that we're just not doing what we need to do. I regret we're doing things, and it's great we're doing things. But the whole theory of Paris was that we were going to send a signal to the marketplace, to the private sector, and the private sector would invest more and begin to move, and then the public sector would buttress that and come in underneath it and leverage activities with it. Regrettably, because of what the federal government is doing under Donald Trump, there's no leadership at all by the United States right now in this. It's all up to the governors and the mayors, which is good. But it's not going to get it done fast enough. As I said a few moments ago, you know, the goal of Paris was to keep the Earth's rise of temperature at 2 degrees centigrade. We are on track right now, Mike, to reach 4 degrees. And 4 degrees is going to have catastrophic consequences for the production of food, for water availability in various parts of the world. We're going to have climate refugees. If you think that migration is a problem today, wait till you see what happens.
We already do have climate refugees.
Well, we already do. Yes, that's accurate. But we're going to have tens of thousands, millions of people dislocated if we continue down there. We're going to have more fires. Look at what happens in California now. We're going to have challenges to our oceans. I'm deeply involved in the oceans, and I started a series of meetings at the State Department to make sure we're making oceans an international concern. And I'm going to have a meeting here with Julie Packard and the folks from the Monterey Aquarium, who are deeply involved in projects to try to do what we need to do to buttress inland waterways and spawning grounds and other things, all of which contribute to rebuffing climate change. But we're in a bad place when it comes to the leadership necessary to get the job done. If a president of the United States today should be convening the G20, an emergency meeting, the G20 should lock the door and not come out until they have in the bank more than the $100 billion that's necessary for the Green Climate Fund to help smaller nations transition to clean energy. We've got to stop building coal-fired power plants. We've got to stop now. I mean, there are critical things we could do. But right now, we're on a course to spend trillions of dollars on mitigation and adaptation, and there are going to be things coming at us that we simply can't stop.
Talking with Senator John Kerry, former senator, five-term senator, and also former secretary of state, and author of a new book called Every Day is Extra. He'll be appearing at Dominican University in San Rafael tonight at 7 p.m. Let me just shift to other matters, particularly since I mentioned it, the Iran deal. There are many who said, including Donald Trump, of course, bad deal, worst deal of all time, particularly because so much money went back to Iran, and Iran was able to use that money to support Hezbollah and to support terrorist forces in Gaza and so forth. Your response to that, I mean, it remains a big question in many people's minds as to whether or not we got ourselves into something that had too much of a downside to it to begin with.
With the Iran agreement?
Yeah.
Well, there's no downside in the Iran agreement. The downside is Donald Trump getting out of the agreement. The agreement stopped Iran from marching rapidly towards a nuclear weapon. When I started the negotiations on the Iran deal, Iran had 12,000 kilograms of enriched material, enough for 10 to 12 bombs. They were enriching at 20% and higher, which is how you make a bomb. They were about to commission a plutonium reactor that would have created plutonium, weapons-grade plutonium. And they had 27,000 centrifuges, 9,000 of which were spinning and enriching. Today, They have less than 5,000 centrifuges that are deployed. They are limited to 3.67% enrichment. You cannot make a bomb at that level. They are limited to 300 kilograms of enriched stockpile, and they're dependent on Russia for fuel. I mean, they were contained. We expanded the breakout time to a nuclear weapon from 2 months to more than a year.
Senator, forgive me, but let's concede the containment. But what about the criticism that came from many quarters that there was a lot of money going back to that regime,
the
mullahs that could be used for terrorist purposes?
The money that went back to the regime was their money, and we were under court order to deliver that money and pay interest every single day the money wasn't delivered back. Why? Because years before, Iran paid for buying weapons from the United States of America. And guess what? They never got the weapons. They paid us. So in a court of law, we lost. We owed the money. And what we did was cut our losses. We restored some of the money. We paid them all so that we had a settlement, which didn't require American taxpayers to pay countless billions of dollars down the road. Now, that was a smart deal, frankly. And the truth is that Iran has lived up to the agreement. I mean, you know, for the next 15 years or more, they have to do things that are unprecedented. Donald Trump saying this deal was a bad deal, given the amount that he lies, absolutely doesn't make it a bad deal.
Actually, and I'm telling you, most of his superlatives, the worst deal of all time.
Right. Well, I'm telling you today that happens to be. And any expert in nuclear proliferation issues will tell you this deal is the strongest, single most demanding, most intrusive and transparent agreement on the planet today.
Are TPP,
and that's not an exaggeration.
TPP and NAFTA good deals too, would you say?
I think TPP could have been tweaked to be improved rather than throw it out. But I think we need a new trade arrangement for the United States that does a better job of helping American workers and is more balanced. And we can do that.
And we can also talk about your autobiography and many other issues. You know, the problem is we only have an hour. And we also have listeners who may indeed want to ask questions of you or bring things to the fore here. And let me tell you, those of you who are listening to us right now, how you can join this program with Senator Kerry, Secretary Kerry, John Kerry. Our toll-free number is JFK, by the way. In fact, you read in his book about how important those initials were in some many respects. You can join us right now. 866-733-6786 is the number for your calls. And again, it's live and it is indeed interactive. 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and you can also post anything on our Facebook page as well for former Secretary of State and five-term U.S. Senator John Kerry. I was thinking about the presidential race. I don't want to necessarily get back to that, but it was interesting because some of the odds makers in Europe actually have at the top two California figures, John Kerry and Kamala Harris, right at the top of the betting. Just want to get that in there. But whether or not we're not going to get into 2020. It is too far off. We are going to get into politics. We already have, though, and geopolitics as well and more with our guest. I want to bring up Vietnam, too, since you mentioned it. When we return on Forum, I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is John Kerry. He's the author of Every Day is Extra. And he'll be at Dominican University in San Rafael tonight at 7 o'clock, but he's with us for the hour, and we're going to get to as many of your calls and emails as we can. Many people want to engage with Senator Kerry and ask questions of him. A couple of things. We were just talking about the 2004 race, and if it hadn't been for Ohio, many of you know John Kerry would be the president of the United States. And I was just thinking, there's always been a question I want to ask you, which is, was it a mistake for you to go out in that, because there was a lot of ridicule involved in it, going out with that camouflage uniform and a gun, hunting geese?
No, the mistake.
Cheney and others made a great deal of fun of it and said, you know, he's not this kind of guy.
If there was a mistake, it was in not pushing back sufficiently on that and taking them on for their masquerade, to be honest with you.
You push back a lot harder on swift boats, too, don't you think?
Correct. And I write that in the book. I write that. Yeah. But there was a question of money. We didn't have – we were under campaign finance reform restraints. I advised Barack Obama as powerfully as I could, if you're going to run for president, you have to go outside the finance system because you cannot run a 50-state campaign on the restraints of the money. And we had the added problem of having a convention in July, and George Bush's was at the end of August. So we had 30 days where we were under the restraint and he was not. And that's when they attacked. So, you know, we had some challenges. But Barack Obama did go outside. And we see the history as a result of that. I don't think anybody will run inside ever again because of the lesson of that. But, you know, I had to pull out of Colorado 3 weeks early. I had to pull out of Virginia 3 weeks early. And as it is, I was the first Democrat to win Fairfax County since Lyndon Johnson in Virginia. We came within a couple of points, but we just didn't have the money to close the gap, and that's a huge difference.
But you had a good deal of money behind you, and one of the things I've never been able to quite understand, I don't want to...
Yeah, but you can't coordinate. You can't coordinate the your advertising. You're not allowed to coordinate. And we adhered to the law. We obeyed the law.
What happened with... I'm an Ohio kid, and I wonder why... You were, I mean, think about Trump now. Somehow he's a populist. He was much more privileged even than you were. And you had a sort of a silver spoon. You went to the finest schools and all that. And, you know, you certainly were, categorized as an elitist and all that kind of stuff. But Trump, who has much more money than all of you, including you and W put together, at least what we have to see his taxes, so we know that for sure. But nevertheless, you know, he has all this kind of working class people behind him.
Because he was... He
connects with them somehow.
Well, he appealed because everybody's angry. And he appealed to that anger. It's understandable. I'm angry. I mean, that sense, people are upset at what's happened after 2008 when the economy crashed. And we had to bail out George W. Bush. And we had to bail out the Republicans, who, by the way, didn't step up. Democrats helped rescue that economy. It's one of the unsung things about Barack Obama. Now's the anniversary of Lehman Brothers, and people are beginning to relook at that period. But the truth is, we were on the cusp of a major implosion of the global financial system. And Barack Obama, before he was even sworn in, Bush was deferring to him for some of the things he chose to do. He came in, he had the bailout and rescue with the loan of the automobile industry, with the stimulus package, and the Republicans voted against it. So Barack Obama started the continuous growth of our economy right up until today. And putting people back to work. There were more than 200,000, 800,000 jobs a month were being lost when President Obama came in. And we turned that around and had 200,000 and 250,000 per month being created. So I think people need to take a hard look at the reality here. But Trump tapped into a sense that Washington was totally not a sense. Washington's dysfunctional.
No, dysfunctional. We kept calling it a swamp.
And it has been a swamp. And Trump tapped into that. And on the right and on the left, you have a legitimate anger about government not producing for the American citizens. And that's a reality. I think we Democrats have to do a much better job of providing an agenda that actually works for those folks.
Well, you
which
have that
Trump
embedded,
is not doing.
You have that embedded
Trump
in your
is
book.
Not doing. Yes, I do have that.
And I want to get to that. But we've got a lot of callers who want to talk with you. So let's
sure.
get to as many as
Whatever
we can.
Whatever you want to do.
Let's go first to George, who's joining us. Good morning, George.
Senator Kerry, you mentioned earlier about problems with the inequities in the American economy and how that adversely affects the 99%. But we have a problem. Voters, at least the voters, are seeing a problem because we have 17 Democratic senators who less than a year ago voted to take away the Dodd-Frank consumer protections for middle-class Americans. And these same 17 senators, Democratic senators, accepted millions of dollars in campaign contributions from the very financial institutions who benefited from this taking away of the consumer protections. So why do you think voters would believe you that the Democrats would help them?
Because the Democrats have been supporting health care. The Democrats support adequate funding for our teachers in education. The Democrats believe in what is happening in climate change and want to respond to it. The Democrats believe in a new energy policy for the United States. Look, I can't speak to every vote they've had in the Congress and said they've all done the right thing. That's not the point. But everything I just listed is a hell of a lot better than a party that started out by nominating a candidate who didn't believe the president, who doesn't even believe in climate change, who doesn't believe that President Obama was born in the United States, a party that believes that the president was not an American, and that made that a central theme of their and a party, by the way, that decided their central obligation in the United States Senate was to make Obama a one-term president. That's irresponsible. So I have no trouble discerning the difference between the two directions without having to defend every single vote that people make in the process. I mean, look, I give you a choice, my friend. You know, we got one Congress. We have one day on which we elect people in America, and too many people don't come out and vote and take part in that. I love what's happening now. I love the fact that so many people are running, that you've got new voices that are articulating a difference. And I think this can be a critical course correction in 2 months. And
that's, but you have a fractured Democratic Party. So the
argument, it's not really fractured the way people are saying. We have a
Democratic Socialists and Bernie people versus maybe
establishment. We have a healthy debate about the choices we face in the country. And I think it's great to have people talking about how we're going to deal with college affordability for everybody and how we're going to deal with health care for all. I mean, those are the things that make a difference for us. And there'll be some differences in how you fund it or how you structure it. But it's a hell of a lot better to have people who want to do that than people who want to destroy it and undo Obamacare.
Here's James, our next caller. James, you're on the air. Good morning.
Thank you, Michael, for taking my call. And Secretary Kerry, I just wanted to say thank you for your service, both military and public. We are all lucky to have had you. I wanted to ask, what do you think we can do to kind of combat all the misinformation that kind of surrounds today's politics? An example would be with the Puerto Rico response, not President Trump, but on Anderson Cooper the other night, they had Rick Santorum, who was saying President Trump's efforts are not to blame, but the efforts of the country of Puerto Rico. Now, first off, Puerto Rico is not a country. Second
Correct.
Off, President Trump is the president of Puerto Rico. And third, no one came back to him. There was no follow-up question. There was no one who corrected him. They just let him continue talking.
Well, I heard him. Actually, I heard it be corrected today. But what you really saw was an exclamation point on why Rick Santorum is not in the United States Senate anymore. And almost enough said. The bottom line is that that you know, to defend all these people who are defending Donald Trump's lies have created some new relationship with you know, the Faustian bargain, if you will, with Lucifer. I mean, this is not a good situation. The fact is that in Puerto Rico, people died for weeks and months afterwards because people didn't get to them, because there was no electricity, because hospitals lost their respirators, and other things happened. I mean, it was dreadful. There was no clean water to drink. People got sick. And for Donald Trump to be oblivious to that, I mean, he goes down there in this phony little situation where he's lobbing towels, paper towel packages at people, was one of the most insulting things I've ever seen in my life. And then to lie about afterwards, to suggest it was a bigger storm than it was, to suggest it knocked out things it didn't knock out, to suggest that, you know, they had superlative delivery system when they had almost no delivery system. You know, there was a clear bias against Puerto Rico, and the president has evidenced it in many different ways on many occasions.
Since the caller raises misinformation, you know, we talked about it a moment earlier about the Swift Boat attacks on you when you were a candidate back in 2004, and I wanted to really find out from
before you run to that, yeah. Can I just emphasize what I just said? There's a series of tweets on Twitter right now with a guy named Daniel Dale who's been correcting a lot of this stuff. But listen to what Donald Trump said. Quote, flashlights, you don't need them anymore. You don't need them anymore. Well, I don't know why he says everything twice, but he does. What was the fact? More than 90% of Puerto Ricans didn't have power at the time he said that. Then he says, I was very honored to see that. I have a lot of respect for the Clinton administration, the head of FEMA, he gave us an A+. Well, guess what? The guy didn't give him an A+. He wasn't talking about the Puerto Rico response. You run down the list. He says, don't forget their electric plant was dead before the hurricane. If you look back on your records, you'll see that the plant was dead. Once again, saying everything twice. Puerto Rican power plants were not dead before the hurricane. This guy is living in an alternative reality. The president of the United States of America. And people are now beginning to catch up to that. Bob Woodward's book obviously documents it. The question is, what are we going to do about it?
Well, that is the question. And, you know, there were a bunch of psychiatrists who got together and gave him a new diagnosis. They said he's not even in the psychiatric books. It's malignant solipsism. I'd never heard that before because they came up with it. There's this, you talk about being in the own world. It's a kind of delusional thing. And yet all of these things that come out that are untruths, that are just clear prevarications.
But what's equally disturbing about it is...
What do you do about them? I mean, you're talking about voting and all the rest of this. There are many people, I hear it all the time on this program from listeners who say, we feel powerless, and you say, vote, vote, talk to your
but
congressional
representative. But we're not powerless. That is what my book is about. I mean, honestly, you know, I've been at this for a long time. And when I came back from Vietnam, we all engaged in activities at the grassroots level. And guess what? We made a difference. We elected the Watergate class of 1974. We changed the direction of a lot of legislation, a lot of things in America as a result.
Can I go to that, by the way, with you? Because I wanted to go there for just a moment. We've got a cut, and I want you to respond to this, particularly in light of the fact what you learned from being swift-boated attacks and like. Let's hear.
I served with John Kerry.
I served with John Kerry.
John Kerry has not been honest about what happened in Vietnam.
He is lying about his record.
I know John Kerry is lying about his first Purple Heart because I treated him for that injury.
John Kerry lied to get his Bronze Star. I know. I was there. I saw what happened.
His account of what happened.
These were all ad hominem, against your integrity
and
your veracity.
Well, it was fake news, alternative facts. But let me give you an example. The last comment was John Kerry lied to get his Bronze Star. I was working as aide to an admiral in New York City when I came back from Vietnam, and he called me in one day and said, congratulations, you're receiving the Bronze Star. I said, what? I knew nothing about it. I had no input to it. An Army captain by the name of Jim Rassman, who lives in Portland, Oregon, or outside of Portland, Oregon, he personally put me in for it because he wanted to thank me for saving his life because he was blown overboard because he was riding on our boat. When a mine went off underneath our boat, he fell into the water. Our guys noticed him later because we were in the middle of a firefight. We saw him taking fire upriver. We turned around, went back, pulled him out of the water, and he personally put me in for that. That's the kind of lie there was. They accused me of having killed some 16-year-old kid behind a hut. And the ABC News went back to Vietnam, interviewed the people involved in that ambush. The wife of the man that was killed said, no, my husband was 26 or 29 years old. He was a professional. His job was to kill the swift boats and the guys on them. I mean, it was lie after lie of distortion.
So what do you do to counter that? I mean, you got...
Well, you have to counter it by countering it with television ads. You go for the same media market.
It comes down to money.
Well, you have to be able to beat back the message. Now, we did that in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, the Miami Herald, the New York Times, Washington Post.
But
all
you could
of them
present all those facts, and there are still people who are going to say
because
they don't believe you.
Because a lot of people,
they
don't read those. They don't read that, number one. And number two, you go to the television market, and you're reaching a whole bunch of different people. You know, people said to me, you know, Kerry, if you win 500,000 more votes than Al Gore did in Ohio, you're going to be president. Well, guess what? We did win more than 500,000 votes. But the Republican Party put a referendum against gay marriage on the ballot, and that brought 300,000 people out that had never voted who wanted to vote against gay marriage. So, you know, there are really – these are what election battles are about, and you have to get deep into the fight to be able to win and to fight back against these things.
Well, your autobiography
is... That's why I
is,
keep coming back.
Your autobiography is a roadmap for this. And I know you've said publicly it's not a political book. You're not necessarily putting it out there for another presidential run. But the fact of the matter is you've laid things out in this book. And I wanted to talk about that, but specifically in terms of what some might see as perhaps, I'll use the word naivete, that somehow this bipartisan notion of you working with McCain and working across the aisle and all that sort of thing, this is the party of Trump now. This is the argument I'm sure you've heard. You can't work across the aisle like you used to. It's too polarized. And yet, and to a great extent, you believe. It's like Chris Matthews saying, we got to go back to the days of Tip O'Neill when the Democrats and Republicans could work together.
But the difficulty today, Michael, is that they have total power in the sense that they have the White House, they have both yes. houses of Congress. So what do you do about the fact they have total power? You got to take that away. How do you take it away? We are a democracy. We value that. That's at the heart and core of who we are. A lot of those guys who died in World War I, World War II, Vietnam, Korea, they died, and today in Afghanistan, Iraq, they're carrying the flag of democracy. They're defending our values. We have to live our values. We have to go out and actually take part to make that democracy meaningful. And by the way, you know, everybody in the world has tried every form of government. You've had monarchies, you've had constitutional monarchy, you've had communism, you've had socialism. Everything's been tried. Winston Churchill said, democracy is the worst form of government except for everything else. And we have to, and we're not making ours work when you only have 54.2% of the eligible voters come out, and yet Obama won with 62%. I mean, that's the story, right?
I wouldn't even mention the fact that Harari was on yesterday, and he was talking about possibly the real decline of liberal democracy. But we've got a caller that pinpoints on something you just mentioned, and that's Afghanistan. And Eric, join us. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you. Secretary Kerry, I served in Afghanistan in 2010-2011 in the Sangin District of Helmand Province. I was with
thank you for that. Were you with the Marines?
I was. I was in the Marine Corps. We took the heaviest casualties of any unit since 2001.
Yes, you did.
I wanted to get your perspective. What is going on with current policy overseas in Afghanistan? When are troops coming home? Because I lost three good friends. We had 200 wounded. We found over 1,000 IEDs. It's a fight that cannot be won, and we need to bring everybody home. I'll take my answer out the air.
Well, thank you very, very much for your service, first of all. I visited you guys in Helmand Province, not you specifically necessarily, but I went down to Helmand Province, and I marveled at the job you guys were doing. It was extraordinary. And yes, under the toughest of circumstances, we went into Afghanistan in order to prevent Afghanistan from having ungoverned spaces in which a platform for terrorism could be launched against the United States, because that's where Osama bin Laden was. And we went in there to get Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. We did that job ultimately. President Obama had the courage to send our forces into Pakistan and took him out. And that was a very courageous decision by the President of the United States, because we all know what happened to Jimmy Carter when he tried a rescue mission in Desert One with the Iranian hostages. So I think in Afghanistan, however, the mission has we'd heard about mission creep, crept into this broader effort to support the government and create something that may not be creatable. We don't know the answer to that yet. I think we need to change the basic strategic goal to go back to what we were doing is prevent the platforms of terror. And there are ways to do that that don't require the kind of level of commitment we have today. But at the same time, we have to get the government there to transition into a self-sustaining capacity. And there's got to be a transitional process. I think there's a way to do that. I don't want to go into the details of it because you always get, you know, cornered with the setting of a date or not a date. I think a lot of that private has to happen in the context of private conversations, and you need to keep the Taliban and others off balance. You don't want to telegraph everything you're doing, but it does have to transition because we're in year 17, I believe, and we're spending billions of dollars there, and I think we have to change the modality.
Brings up another question that I'd like to ask you in terms of serving as a major diplomat and Secretary of State and fighting in a war and everything. Where do you think right now? I remember Bill Clinton said, aside from the Middle East, the most dangerous hotspot in the world is India-Pakistan. I think now one could argue maybe North Korea, but then President Trump has tried to jimmy things up on that score and say they're moving toward denuclearization. ISIS, he said, he takes credit for, although Obama did a hell of a lot against ISIS.
Well,
we haven't even talked about Syria.
Let me just be very clear.
I was just going to ask you directly, though. What do you think right now is the most serious hotspot in the world or the most serious place to be concerned about because of volatility or danger, peril, whatever?
Well, I don't want to get into most. I think there are three or four key things happening, maybe even five, and we got a lot of trouble spots. Korea is one of them, absolutely, and no question about it, and I hope the president can get more precise about what denuclearization means, about who accepts what definition between them, and what will happen to begin to determine the location and numbers of weapons that they have and how they're going to proceed to gain control over it. That, we're a far cry from that. But the Middle East remains a powder keg in many different ways. You have radical extremism in that region that is fed by many different things. There are different ingredients. What's happening in Syria is an utter disgrace. And the international community is responsible for not coming together in order to leverage Assad into a different posture.
Senator, I'm coming up on a break, but I have to ask you, because President Obama was so severely criticized about that red line in Syria.
Well, obviously, and we paid a large price for the perception of that. But the fact is, we got 1,300 tons of declared chemical weapons out of Syria in the middle of a conflict. And the OPCW that did it won the Nobel Peace Prize for carrying out that. So obviously something significant happened. But it was not a good message. It gained a mythology, let me just put it that way, and it cost us.
Let me remind listeners that you are listening to Forum. We're talking with John Kerry, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support this radio station, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny, and we'll go to another caller, and let's have Philip join us. Philip, you're on.
Yes. Senator Kerry, I want to ask you what Faustian agreement you had with the devil, you and Barack Obama, for not submitting the Paris Accords and the Iranian agreement to the Senate. Henry Cabot Lodge submitted the League of Nations agreement to the Senate. Bill Clinton submitted NAFTA to the Senate. Perhaps you should go windsurfing in the San Francisco Bay so everybody could get pictures of you. Then you could take your ketchup wife with you. Then the people would understand why 60 million people did not vote for Hillary Clinton. And they did not because they detest the actions of arrogant Ivy Leaguers like you and Barack Obama.
Let me go to the heart of your question.
Thank you very much for your extremely personal and obviously disturbed question. I don't windsurf anymore, actually. I kitesurf, and I'm delighted at my age to be able to do it. It's a great sport, and I will never apologize for it.
You're going to do it here in the Bay Area?
No, I don't have time. I'm running around. But let me just be very clear to you. The Republicans denied Robert Dole, a Republican, former majority leader, the privilege of seeing one of the great accomplishments of his life ratified as a treaty in the United States Senate for the Disabilities Act. The Americans Against Disabilities Act, which raises the standards all around, would have raised the standards all around the world of how American citizens with disabilities are treated in other countries when they travel abroad. So if you had a United States Marine who was wounded in Afghanistan, and that Marine was in a wheelchair, that Marine could travel in the rest of the world and have the same standards applied to him elsewhere as we apply to them here at home. That's a patriotic thing to do. And the current Republican Senate would not vote for it because they think it's giving up American sovereignty, because it's somehow against our value system. That's a dishonor to everybody who laid down their life for our country to have people treated decently in other countries in the world. And that's the United States Senate we face today. So you're right. The president, first of all, it wasn't a treaty. It wasn't required to be submitted. It was an executive agreement. And that executive agreement, Donald Trump undid it. Did he go to Congress and ask Congress to undo it? No. He undid it himself because it's an executive agreement. So that's the peril of what happened. But it happened because the Senate is incapable of passing even the most innocuous, simplistic kind of treaty because of pure ideology and stubbornness. So, look, I'm sorry you resent people who are educated one place or another. It's too bad. But I think Barack Obama took that education and did a hell of a lot more with it than your Ivy League president who went to Penn. The one I'm talking about is Donald Trump.
Well, that caller obviously had some issues with you, and so it may be time to read some remarks of callers who feel very differently. Craig says, thank you for your service and for buoying my spirits today, John Kerry. And Carol writes, go John Kerry. I feel just as you do, as so many of us do, but other than supporting you and supporting the groups I believe in with my voice and my dollars, what are we to do? There's that question again.
Well, I think you can get involved in a campaign. I mean, the lifeblood of a campaign is people who are willing to go out and knock on doors, drive a car on election day to get people to the polls who have trouble traveling, help be part of a campaign, do a fundraiser, help to bring your friends to the table. There's so many different things that people can do on an everyday basis. Go out with truth sheets of paper that show people where they can go to actually determine that a particular statement is factual, begin to restore facts to the American political process. I mean, there really is a limitless activity, and young people particularly. I can't emphasize this enough. All the great changes and movements, and by the way, it wasn't nirvana. A lot of mistakes were made in the 1960s, 70s, but the one thing that came out of it was this incredible sense of possibility, the spirit of engagement. And young people, kids in college, took semesters off and went to New Hampshire and worked in the primary campaigns. That's how Gene McCarthy sent Lyndon Johnson the message, you can't run again. I mean, it changed history. We used to call it the peanut butter and jelly brigade, the kids who were living off peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. They had no money. They bunked, 20 to a small apartment or something, but they worked in the campaign and they brought about change. We got to get back to making our democracy work.
We got seconds left here. Should Nancy Pelosi stay in the position she's in?
I love Nancy Pelosi. I think she's a terrific person. I think she's been a terrific leader. And I hope the House of Representatives will make the right decision. It's up to them what to do afterwards. But I would personally, obviously, be very supportive of Nancy.
John Kerry, good to have you on. Thank you for joining us.
And by the way, they've spent millions of dollars trying to destroy her reputation. That's what Republicans do.
He'll be at Dominican University tonight, 7 p.m. His book, again, Every Day is Extra. Stay tuned for another hour ahead of Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.